You wanted the best. You've got the best podcast. The hottest podcast in the world. The Chris Voss Show, the preeminent podcast with guests so smart you may experience serious brain bleed. Get ready. Strap yourself in. Keep your hands, arms, and legs inside the vehicle at all times, because you're about to go on a monster education roller coaster with your brain. Now, here's your host, Chris Voss.
Hi, folks. It's Voss here from thechrisvossshow.com, thechrisvossshow.com. Hey, we're coming here with another great podcast. We certainly appreciate you tuning in. Be sure to refer the show to your family, friends, relatives. Get them subscribing to the podcast everywhere you can do that. Go to youtube.com/ChrisVoss. Hit the bell notification button. Also, go to goodreads.com/ChrisVoss and all the other groups we have for Chris Voss, The Chris Voss Show on Instagram, TikTok, all those different places. Check those out as well. Today, we have another amazing author on the show. His name is Lucas Bezier. He is the author of the new book that just came out May 18th, 2021, Running Out in Search of Water on the High Plains. So we're going to be talking about some interesting stuff here about what's going on with our world and environment. And this episode is brought to you by our sponsor, ifi-audio.com, and their micro IDSD signature. It's a top of the range desktop transportable DAC and headphone app that will supercharge your headphones. It has two Brown Burr DAC chips in it and will decode high-res audio and MQA files. We're using it in the studio right now. I've loved my experience with it so far. It just makes everything sound so much more richer and better and takes things to the next level. IFI Audio is an award-winning audio tech company with one aim in mind: to improve your music enjoyment of quality sound, eradicate noise, distortion, and hiss from your listening experience. Check out their new incredible lineup of DACs and audio enhancement devices at ifi-audio.com. He is an American author, filmmaker, and anthropologist. His fieldwork has taken him across the Americas, from the Arctic and lowland to South America. He spent over a decade spent with the recently contacted Royo people, I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, in the Gran Quechua of Paraguay. I'll stand to be corrected after this, I guess. His travels brought him back to his ancestral homes in the Great Plains, and he is currently an associate professor of anthropology at the University of Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Lucas, and did I butcher the Arroyo people?
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. Yes, you butchered that.
I'm sorry.
But it's all right.
How do you pronounce it?
Iareo.
So yeah. My apologies to the audience. We just lost the Iareo people. Gran Cacho, does that?
Gran Chaco, yeah.
Gran Chaco? Yeah. I'm hungry. Chaco Talk is a Taco Bell now or whatever. I don't know. But my apologies to our Paraguay audience that clearly has abandoned the show at this point. We'll try and get it right next time. But this is how we learn. So Lucas, welcome to the show. Congratulations on the new book. Give us your plugs so people can find you on the interwebs.
Thank you. You can find the book at the Princeton University Press website or on Amazon. You can find out a little bit more about me and my projects at my website, lucasbessier.net.
And so you wrote this book. What motivated you to write this book? Is this your first book?
This is my second book. And my first book was on my field work with Iareo people in the Gran Chaco. And I'd spent a long time in South America doing that kind of work. I'm originally from Western Kansas, but I left in my 20s after I finished my undergraduate degree. And I went to Bolivia for a while. And then I was back and forth between New York, where I was getting my PhD, and Paraguay. I was trying to understand during those early trips how environmental destruction in the Chaco was altering the lives of a recently contacted native group. And that's what my first book explores. But then I returned home only to discover that a similar process was unfolding on the plains where I grew up.
Oh, wow.
And that had to do with the extreme depletion of the Oglala Aquifer. The book began because I didn't know what to do with that. Mm-hmm. I was trying to understand how those logics were actually replicated in my own family history, how I was implicated in the things that I had been critiquing somewhere else, and how I could try to grapple with that environmental crisis, which was coinciding in 2016 with the rise of the American far in the public sphere, and with my own efforts to reconnect with my father and build a relationship that was more sustainable with him. It started there, and that began a journey for 2 years back and forth to Western Kansas that brought me face to face with my own complicity. It brought me face to face with the problems of industrial agribusiness in that area, and also with the kind of bigger conundrums of American democracy that many of us are trying to understand and grapple with, how we can get out of some of the divides that are really fracturing this country. That's what the book was really trying to do. And along the way, I discovered my grandmother's archives, which I didn't know really existed. And it turns out that she was a local historian. She had been working on similar questions. And those archives gave me a kind of orientation or a guide through some of the more complicated layers of my own family history. And then eventually, it turns out that I discovered that my own kind of emotional registers or habits that I learned from my family were really mirrored in the dilemmas of aquifer depletion.
Oh, wow.
So the book is trying to map that out and trying to understand the cultural, social, political forms that drive depletion and ask what we can do about it.
Okay. I guess let's lay a foundation on a few different terms on what an aquifer is. If you could explain that to some people that might be laymen in the industry of what an aquifer is and how it works.
Yeah, thanks for that question, Chris. So I grew up imagining aquifers as these kind of massive underground lakes or oceans or rivers. And it turns out that's not exactly the way that many of them are. There's a lot of different kinds. Some of them are shallow. Some of them are deep. Some of them are porous. They have a lot of interaction with the surface. Some of them are hardly any interaction with the surface. They don't recharge hardly at all. And the aquifer that the book treats, and that is really under parts of 8 states in America and a huge part of the heartland and drives a huge portion of American agriculture, is the Oglala Formation of the High Plains Aquifer. The Oglala Formation seems to be a singular thing, but once again, it isn't. It's a more complicated story. So what it is, this unmapped mass of water-bearing sand. Some of it is gravel, some of it is sand. Some of the pockets are big and wide and flat, and they're connected. So if you draw from one part, it takes from another part. Other places or other parts of the aquifer aren't. They're confined, they're vertical, they can be interrupted, they can be layered in a lot of different ways. And so that complexity, which again is so vast that a lot of people don't really have it figured out as a whole unit, means that depletion operates in a very particular weird way. That's not exactly the kind of imaginary that I at least had as a kid, of one cup with a lot of different straws in it declining at the same rate. It's not really like that.
So what's the size of this aquifer that you're talking about, this big one?
It's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, it stretches under parts of 8 states in terms of the actual amount of water that's stored in it. I'm not a hydrologist. I'm an anthropologist. But people have done estimates, and you can find that information pretty easily. But it's a huge amount of water.
That's interesting. I know I lived in Vegas for about 20 years, and Vegas brings all its water in off of the natural springs or whatever aquifer that's underneath the desert there. A lot of people think the water comes from Lake Mead, but it doesn't. They have these pumps, as you probably know, they pump the bad water down into the ground to let it filter it. And then they pump the other water up, which is an interesting thing how they do that. Are you familiar with how that works in Vegas, I imagine?
I'm not familiar with the Las Vegas case. I know that the Central Valley in California is also an intensive aquifer-based agricultural and social form. And there's other parts around the world where you have aquifers that are similar to the Great Plains Aquifer, the High Plains Aquifer, where they're confined and they're deep and they don't really recharge in a quick or even way. Mm-hmm.
And so what are some of the challenges that you found with what's going on with these aquifers in the plains and water use in America?
The big challenge is that in many parts of the Great Plains, many parts of the places that draw on aquifer water for agricultural profits, but also for the real economic basis of society, taxes, schools, hospitals, those kinds of things, are based on an unsustainable use model. And that's causing a really rapid decline in many parts. There's other parts where it's not true, where people have organized and are doing great work to conserve or at least slow the rate of decline. And then there's other parts or other places where that isn't happening. And that's the part that I'm from. That's the part that I'm trying to understand, which is...
Now, that's largely Kansas then?
The southern states, the southern portions of the aquifer, there's parts that are already effectively depleted. Wow. And people can't use it anymore. And then there's places where there's a little left. And then there's places where there's declines, but they're not super serious. And so the place that I'm from is Southwest Kansas. That has one of the highest rates of aquifer loss in the entire Oglala region. The specific family land that the book radiates out of, the stories come from this particular place. That place has one of the highest rates of loss in Southwest Kansas. Which means it has one of the highest rates of aquifer loss in the entire world. And you're talking about declines. I think the median decline across the Oglala or across Southwest Kansas is around 105, 106 feet, but some places have a lot more. In this particular place, it's around 200 feet.
Wow. Wow. So once these aquifers run out, do they refill in any way, shape, or form? Or does it take a long time for water to trickle down, get down there and refill them?
Yeah, so it seems, and again, I'm not an expert, and there's people who know much more about this than I do, but from what I understand, aquifers recharge in one of two ways, either horizontally, that is through subsurface flows that come in from another place, or vertically from the surface down. And again, some aquifers are really shallow, and there's a lot of flow in and out, and it's a real dynamic interaction with the surface. Other aquifers and other parts of the same aquifer may be deep and confined without a lot of vertical flow at all. And the portions of the aquifer that I'm concerned with or that I was writing about have an extremely low rate of recharge. They're considered fossil waters or non-renewable waters, which means they're almost sealed off in many places from any interaction with the surface. And the horizontal flows are also diminished or blocked in many places. So you're talking about a recharge rate in certain places that's a tenth of an inch per year.
Oh, wow.
Or maybe 1 inch per year. Mm-hmm. And then you're talking about declines of 6 feet per year or 8 feet per year. So recharge is really a dynamic question. It's something that's different in every spot, but then there are places in which recharge is basically not happening. And that means to recharge it by natural processes, you're talking about a timeline of way beyond a human lifetime. You're talking hundreds, thousands of years mm-hmm. to recharge or replenish. So recharge is not really an answer for the kinds of unsustainable depletion in many parts of the Oglala.
So you talk about different things that are causing this, possibly, I'm assuming possibly, industrial agriculture, eroding democratic norms, and the surreal interpretations of a looming disaster. So I imagine there's some politics of this that play in. And then we've seen industrial agricultural, industrial pig raising and stuff. Everything in our food these days is industrial scale. And you have to wonder, yeah, how much resources are being stripped from different areas for this. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris. And again, every area or every spot of depletion has its own configuration. This particular spot that I'm writing from, almost all of the water, I think it's 99% of the water that's taken out goes to industrial agriculture, either raising irrigation-fed crops or being used in the processing of those crops.
Oh, wow.
And what's interesting, and many people have pointed this out, all these things that I'm saying, they're not my original research. There's a lot of experts who've filled in all kinds of pieces of these puzzles. But one of the most complicated things or complex things, frustrating things, is that the economics also in many places don't make sense in terms of how they're discussed or in terms of how they're imagined at a local level, where you have big corporations making the profits, exporting the kind of economic benefits elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Local communities end up struggling to make ends meet, all while continuing to pump or pumping even more than in the past.
What do you think of the Nestle thing? If you're familiar with that, I think it's up in Oregon or somewhere in California. Nestle has like these rights where they can basically just drain this whole lake and area and water use, and they can just do whatever they want. It's like carte blanche or something. What do you think of stuff like that or some of the other industrial stuff that's going on, like you say?
I think that the water frontier is a really important one, and I'm really glad that it's garnering national attention. I think that all of these dynamics, you're talking immediately about questions of access, you're talking about questions of equity, you're talking about the limits of property, you're talking about the illusions of profit, individual profit versus collective profit, how profit's defined temporally. Maybe things make sense economically if you define it in one time scale, but if you stretch that out, maybe they don't make sense. And so you have a lot of different pressure points on a democratic system and on an American imaginary of who we are, who belongs where, what it means to grow up and live a good life that really are shaken up by these kinds of inequities. And I think that surface water is, there's a lot of activist movements around water rights. There's a lot of people who have done a really great job calling attention to water access as a human, as a legal domain. There's a lot of people doing that. There's less attention paid to the human rights associated with aquifers or groundwater, partly because it's less visible. It's easier to not imagine or not really grapple with the amount of water that is being taken out to benefit a very few at the expense of a whole bunch of people. And I think that that cuts right back to all of these issues that a lot of people are discussing right now. We're on the forefront of our national imaginary around how are we all complicit? How are we connected, actually? And how are these slogans that are used to divide us being manipulated to keep us from taking responsibility for our own ties to people in other places and our mutual obligations to each other?
Is that really what's at fault here? Is the industrialization, billionaires just wanting to do whatever they want and be able to make as much money, just rampant profitability? Is that what some of the real problem is here and what we're seeing?
I think the problems are really wide ranging and deep rooted. And I think that there's a lot of different ways in which our logics for making sense out of the contemporary moment, our logics for understanding problems like aquifer depletion, are already co-opted and they prevent an effective solution from being found. So yeah, on one hand, you have this like unchecked industrial profiteering. On the other hand, you have people that can't seem to find common ground with each other in order to build alliances that would be effective and able to really focus on issues of shared concern and shared values, which I think really do exist for many people, even though it's hard often to find that or it's easy to lose sight of that.
Yeah, it definitely is. I think, is it because we just take water for granted? Is that one of the issues that we have where we just, water, it's always there. It's like air. Yeah, it's always there. Is that maybe one of the issues as to why we don't take it, why we don't give it more pause?
Yeah, I think that there's a whole social system based on free water, which is fine as long as it's unlimited. Cases, people used to think that, and these were decent, smart people, but that's what they believed. And in their lifetime, it proved to be true. And now we're facing another kind of a situation. So yeah, when people think that it's unlimited, you can get into problems because then it lets you not address the more difficult questions of hierarchy, of authority, of truth, of trust, and who gets to benefit and who doesn't.
That's really interesting. Would this be happening without the industrialization of our food chain, or would this still be happening with just these aquifers are dying out and not being replenished? Or consumption is just too out of control. One of those.
Yeah, it's hard for me to say hypothetically what we all would have done without industrial pressure points or industrial momentum fueling a lot of this. It's very difficult to say. But what I do know is that now, given the situation, there's a real divide between people, farmers, producers, who are interested in conserving water for future generations, and farmers or producers who feel like they would conserve if they had a choice, but they feel compelled to not be able to conserve by terms of bank financing, by the terms of the infrastructure that they've put in, by the investments, by who controls the land, by debt, those kinds of things. And then there's also a group of people who have really internalized those kinds of industrial logics of extermination. And those are the debates which mirror the debates in this country. And I think that if you really get down to brass tacks, it's about people who are committed to having a sustainable future for future generations in those places versus people who think that the task, the way you become a good person, the way you meet your dreams is to completely extract everything that's available and move on to some other place. And unfortunately, you can't keep moving on, you know?
How soon, is there any projections on how soon this body of water that you've talked about in the central U.S. would, at its current pace, would become empty?
Once again, it's a really good question, and it's a question of a lot of debate. And you have different sides throwing out different projections based on whatever agenda they're wanting to push. But basically, the reason why depletion can continue is because these are such idiosyncratic systems, or they're in every place, the characteristics are so distinct that, again, a lot of places are already, they've run out. But there's other places where maybe they can go for 10 more years. Then there's other places maybe they can keep going for 30 years, and it's not even. So there's a patchiness that has nothing to do with how the land looks, has nothing to do with the quality of the soil or who got there first. It's a kind of subterranean variability that isn't taken into account when we're talking about equity, when we're talking about access, when we're talking about responsibility or accountability. Who is accountable for draining which piece? That all comes down to what that piece looks like and the particular history in that place. And so the short answer to that question about ultimate timelines is that there's multiple different timelines for different places. And some places, again, Texas Panhandle, Oklahoma Panhandle, Southwest Kansas, Western Kansas, they're already out. And it ain't going to come back. And then there's other places where nearby, a place that's completely out, they have water, they can keep going. And the question is, at what point do you have a bigger reckoning around that kind of perpetuation of haves and haves not, have nots in rural America as well?
Wow. So do you talk in the book about how we need to fix this? We just need to come together politically, which doesn't sound like that's going to happen. Do we have to go through a crisis thing where we run out or somebody runs out and all of a sudden we have to start running around with their hair on fire and we should finally do something about this, that classic crap that we always do?
Yeah. Again, to be fair, there's a lot of people who are really great people, super smart people, super dedicated people, super committed people who are spending a huge amount of energy working on this and are actively involved in trying to figure out a better way forward. That said, I think that in Kansas, at least, there are political solutions that are available. The state can take action. The local groundwater management districts, which were set up in the 1970s to basically create a kind of intermediate political structure between local communities and the state, because a lot of people didn't want the state telling them what to do. Mm-hmm. So they set up these kind of other organizations. Those organizations could do something. They're in charge. They have that authority. But the trick is that in Kansas, at least, only certain people can participate in those intermediary political forums. And those people are only the producers who benefit from draining the water. Oh, wow. So the townspeople, the people in that don't own land already, i.e. the not privileged people, have no say in the democratic process. Wow. And that's the vast majority of citizens in that area. So you could reform those political organizations to give more people a seat at the table that actually will determine their own futures. The state could intervene. That's politically difficult often in Kansas. And citizens can take action. So there are clear solutions. The ultimate answer is a zero net loss policy where you can preserve the things that are there. You can actually do studies that take into account the differences of aquifer regions and build a kind of framework that is an honest, real, hard look at the situation.
Wow. Wow.
And that's different, of course. I have to be careful. That's particular to Kansas and this particular thing. Different states have different laws, work in different ways. Different policies are in place in other places. So,
yeah, water law is all over the place with all the different things that are out there. So this is very interesting. So people can get a good sense of what's going on with our water supplies, what's going on with everything in our world, and hopefully how to resolve it. Any parting thoughts about the book and what's inside of it that you want to share or tease out to people?
It's a real privilege to be able to share part of my story, which is a family story as well. And I think that one of the things that all of us are called to do at this moment of crisis and change is to really take a hard look at where we come from and how we're complicit, and to get beyond this kind of rural, urban, progressive, conservative divide and start looking at the things we have in common with other people, as tough as that may be.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely what we need to do and somehow get on track. We've got to quit consuming everything and just breeding. There's like it's going out of style. Because everybody thinks resources on this planet will live forever. And I think coronavirus shows us that the planet's getting sick of us.
Yeah, that's right.
The planet, yeah, I think we're done with you. Let's try and figure out some ways that we can get rid of you guys. thin the herd out a little bit. But yeah, it's definitely something we got to be concerned about. So Lucas, it's been wonderful to spend time with you today and learn all this stuff. Give us your plugs so people can find you on the interwebs.
Yeah, you can find the book on Amazon. You can find the book at the Princeton University Press page. And you can find a little bit more about me at my website, lucasbessier.net.
There you go. And Lucas, thank you very much for being on the show and sharing this data with us.
Hey, Chris, I really appreciate it.
We really appreciate it, too. Congratulations on the new book. It's Running Out in Search of Water on the High Plains by Lucas Bessier. Be sure to check it out. Order up at your local booksellers where you can get the latest copy. Be the first one in your book club to take and read it. You can go to youtube.com/ChrisVoss to see the video version of this. You can also go to goodreads.com/ChrisVoss. All of our groups on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. Find them all those places, Instagram. And thanks, Modest, for tuning in. We'll see you guys next time.